Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. On today's show...
Concrete is a very heavy material, so I wanted to make it much lighter than it is. There are a lot of ways to get to a product. To invent the material is one way.
We speak to three young designers innovating with new materials, foam, rattan and cork to start with, at this year's Interzum Furniture Production Fair in Cologne. Next up, author Owen Hopkins joins our producer to discuss his new book, looking at the social and political history of some of Britain's finest post-war architecture.
It would not just be a kind of visual manifestation of the post-war ideals of social progress, of creating a society that would be better for everyone, but it was a sense that architecture itself would have some kind of effect too.
And last up, we exit through the gift shop of London's Victoria and Albert Museum, to be precise. We see how retail can elevate the offerings at the world's largest museum dedicated to the decorative arts and design. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. And we begin this week's show with a report from Cologne, where Interzum, a furniture and interiors production fair, wrapped up last week. Now, while no one's going to accuse the fair of being the sexiest on the design calendar, it's here that many of the big innovations in manufacturing are brought to the market. Monocle's intrepid reporter Chiara Romello is there and brings us this report.
Every other year, one of the interiors industry's leading fairs, Interzum, lands in Cologne. But unlike the Salone del Mobile, its glamorous Italian cousin in Milan, this fair isn't really about furniture design. Rather, it's about the manufacturing of it. Across 10 halls, over 1,500 companies in the business of making anything from wood panels to hinges showcase their wares, while the technical offices of big international furniture brands scout for suppliers. Decisions on what materials to choose for a design often remain behind the scenes, only discussed between insiders. But they are, of course, vital in the definition of the look and feel of any project. That's why some emerging designers have taken it into their hands to develop materials of their own to suit their aesthetic purpose and their functional needs. I caught up with three creatives from around Germany who used this fair to present their ideas for brand new materials. First up, it's David Antonin from Nirok Studio, based just outside Cologne. His new material is called Corkrete. As the name suggests, it's a beautiful mixture of concrete and cork, which may look a bit like terrazzo, but has many of the advantages of cork.
Well, the idea started while I was still at the university. I was in a program which wanted to make give concrete a new aesthetic. So I thought, okay, what could be nice about it? And I thought, okay, concrete is a very heavy material, so I wanted to make it much lighter than it is in two ways, optically and also in a haptical way. I tried to mix a lot of different kinds of materials like fabrics or fibers into the cement, and in the end, yeah, I found cork and thought, okay, that's a very good idea. It's much lighter and it looks nice.
Where can the properties of the material take it? Do you intend it for flooring? Do you intend it for furniture? We can see it here in front of us on some stools and some tables. So it looks like here it's in a furniture kind of declination. But what kind of applications can it have?
It's also very nice for wall coverings, for example, because it also absorbs a lot of sound. When you enter a room and you have cork on the walls, it's much more welcoming. But we also think in every way, like you already said, flooring and also for furniture, because it's much lighter and you can also easily move it around in your home.
An awful lot of the material developers don't come from a product design background, but come from an engineering background. How important do you think it is to have product designers thinking about material and coming up with new materials?
I think it's very important because we are, in the end, we are the people who work with the materials that are on the market, because we work with the companies and we also want to do innovation also in our products and the furniture. Yeah, right from the beginning, a good start to define what is the next step to work with.
How important are material considerations when you design product? Does the idea for the product come first and then you fill your idea with the material that you think can work with it? Or do you start with the material first?
It depends. It's a lot of times it comes from the material. For example, we are working a lot with glass. We just like the process of producing the glass and heating it and everything which comes around. We also, for example, sometimes have an idea about an old technique or an old piece of furniture which doesn't exist like that in the moment, and we think, oh yeah, that's a pity, why isn't it used anymore? There are a lot of ways to get to a product. To invent the material is one way.
For design studio Out for Space, the idea for a new material came from the will to rediscover the once uber-popular rattan. From their studio in Baden-Württemberg, the team came up with a material called Karun. By injecting rattan capillaries with colours and resins, they have created a material that is both resistant and flexible. Research and development manager Moritz Kohn tells me more.
The start of our project or our concept is how it's called, the rattan palm. We injecting in the capillaries our colors. In the end, we make the performance of rattan much more interesting. We try to don't use that plastics and give a solution for plastic products. So we are able to drop it in a section where only plastics could work.
Why is it better to use your material than timber, for example? What's the advantage?
The properties and the benefits of this material is, for example, the stretching possibilities, the forming possibilities. It's really homogene, so you can stick together parts and the sticking points are not visible anymore, so you can make big sheets. It's not breaking, so it's not even possible to break. It's like it's a mix between textile, sometimes I tell it, and a wooden veneer.
You would know an awful lot about it because you used to be a carpenter, didn't you? So what was your personal background and how did you get from being a carpenter to design and eventually to develop such a material?
I was always trying to experiment a lot with material. I was really interested to make out more out of it, more out of carpentering. So I was a little bit bored about to build up concepts for somebody. I wanted to make the concepts. And that was the point why I went to the high school in Schwäbisch Gmünd. It's an art high school for product design. And I was studying there. Yeah, I had the possibility to make my own designs and I opened my own workshop. Three-dimensional forming specialist in veneers.
How important do you think is for a product designer to be coming up with a material concept?
I think we get the feelings and the processes and the eye of a designer. I call me more process designer. In the background I have the aesthetics, but I try to make perfect processings. I want to have easy production, not many steps. It have to be clear, it have to be natural. This is for me points I have to reach, I try to reach every day to make it simple.
Some materials can really shape our experience of furniture without us even noticing. Think of foam, for example. It may often be hidden underneath layers of upholstery, but without it, a sofa wouldn't really be a sofa at all. Working in collaboration with chemical company Covestro, young creatives Dorothea Klazen, Adam Pajonk and Sasha Pret have devised a new kind of foam that, thanks to an internal structure, can hold shapes really well. I spoke to Klazen about how the idea came about.
The original idea came up on the workshop that was provided by Covestro at the FH Münster with a lot of students, architects and designers all mixed together. And I've never worked with foam before, so it was for me also a new material and I was excited to learn more about its abilities. And the idea basically was to give the foam a bone structure inside, to control the foam's behavior and to change the material itself.
And what kind of properties does this foam then have? If you take a normal piece of foam and then this, what more can you do?
First of all, you can give the foam different degrees of stiffness. This is really interesting if you know more about how foam is manufactured in general. Also, we can, let's say we can 3D print structures inside of the foam that really change the foam's behavior. For example, if you push the foam, it will maybe bend into one direction, just because the structure inside is guiding the foam to behave like this. And in our project, I found it really interesting because we started with the material itself and changed its properties without thinking about the application first. But during our research project that we did together with Covestro, we talked to companies, to people who work with foam for years. We found out that our technology has so many applications in so many products because foam is in a lot of products. So I think it was interesting to first come up with the technology itself and then to explore a lot of applications.
Can we come up with new materials without using digital tools? Or do you think the most interesting and the most revolutionary materials will come from digital technologies?
I wouldn't say that digital tools are always the best solution to come up with new ideas. I would say that it's fascinating that you can use computer-aided software to come up with structures and ideas that are so unique that you couldn't maybe think about them by yourself, but you're able to use the computer to generate these structures. And also, our technology wouldn't be possible without using the robot arm to be so precisely. So I think it's important to think about digital tools and to combine them with a material and how products are made right now. But I think we need to use them clever and to always consider the social component as well. If you use digital tools, what's left behind and what can you improve? Because sometimes older techniques, like handcrafted techniques, can still be an inspiration and should not be forgotten, but they can be combined with this new technology.
Of course, there's a lot of rigorous science to devising a new material, but a designer brings something extra to the planning table, the perspective of somebody who's going to be mounting, molding, and plying those ingredients to fit an idea they could, until then, perhaps only imagine. From Cologne at Interzum, I am Chiara Romella.
Owen Hopkins is an architectural writer, historian and curator whose recent book, Lost Futures and the Disappearing Architecture of Postwar Britain, is out now. The Handsome Number explores the 35 buildings constructed in Britain's creative high watermark between the end of the Second World War and 1979. Far from another revisionist romp through our modish admiration for mid-century architecture that simply coos at concrete, the title takes a closer look at the ambition and ideals that underpinned post-war British architecture. This is a lively lament for a few too-ugly-to-last structures and an informed eye on the importance of those that still stand. Owen Hopkins joined this show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan, in studio to mull it all over.
Social housing has its roots in the 19th century. There was significant social housing built before the war, but it became hugely important after the war as a consequence of a huge housing crisis. So much housing had been destroyed in the Blitz, but it was also an opportunity that was seized upon by planners and architects to knock down huge slum areas which had existed since the 19th century and rebuild them in a wholly modern way. And I think some people kind of forget how bad most of the housing was in cities all over Britain at that time, and sort of now in some ways lament the destruction of some of that Victorian heritage. But these were, you know, slums, very often rat infested, toilets outside. So to have a new concrete modern house that had internal plumbing, had central heating, was warm, was an extraordinary change. And it reflected the ideal of the state playing an active role in housing provision. This is something that hasn't existed since 1979. And, you know, it wasn't just that the state would provide some kind of social safety net. It was really that social housing would be available to anyone who wanted it. So it was really a question of the state intervening heavily in the market because they felt the market wouldn't deliver what was really required.
Let's talk about some of the buildings that are featured in the book.
As you said, these are buildings, most of which have been demolished, some that are going to be, and then some that have been heavily altered. You know, with the risk of talking too much about housing, because the book's not just about housing, but another, I think, really interesting example is Balfron Tower, which is a tower by Erno Goldfinger in Poplar in East London. It's sort of the sister building to probably the more famous Tredick Tower in Kensington. And this is an extraordinary piece of brutalism in its purest form in many ways, this quite wide tower and then a service block on the side with these walkways going across every third floor. The lifts only stopped at every third floor. That was the reason why they were only needed there. Now, this was a great symbol of, that could be seen for miles around, of the aspirations of post-war housing. And the flats themselves are incredibly well designed and well laid out. One of the criticisms, sort of the very cliched criticisms of the architects of this era is that, you know, they were building these great concrete things and then they were living in, you know, Georgian houses themselves. They wouldn't deign to live in them themselves. But Goldfinger actually did, with his wife Ursula, and stayed in a flat there for 3 months to get a sense of how it worked as a building, how it worked as a place to live, and whether it was successful in terms of fostering a community. And famously, they hosted champagne receptions for residents in their flats. This was literally champagne socialism. After a few months, he moved out, returned to his modernist house in Hampstead. And the building, its history, never lived up to those lofty ambitions, but, you know, remained, you know, high quality place to live with, you know, very generously laid out flats with, you know, wide balconies that were almost like another room, you know, far more useful than the sort of tacked on balconies that you get in most housing going up now. It's included in the book, even though it's there, because it's now undergoing a process of renovation and the flats are not going to be returned back to social use. They're all being sold off privately, which is a complete reversion of the ideals that created this building. And the logic is that the tower is acting as a kind of a cash cow and providing funds to regenerate the surrounding estate. But the symbolism, I think, is so important, and that is of this symbol of post-war optimism and broad social ideals is being replaced by development for private interest and to be occupied by people working at Canary Wharf. It's the essential question around brutalism at the moment. Just picking up Balfron Tower again, I mean, it's interesting that it can be now sold off privately, and that is an indication of the change in how people see brutalism and, you know, more broadly architecture of the post-war moment. And now it's become fashionable, now it's become attractive, and there's almost a premium that can be charged by getting a flat in Balfron Tower or indeed somewhere like the Barbican. But the aesthetic is a very interesting question. You know, now brutalism is, you know, appears on tea towels and mugs and plates and all sorts of things. And it's partly to do with the sort of cyclical nature of fashion and trends. And it's no coincidence that a lot of the people who are interested in architecture of this era and share photos online are born in the 1980s. So they haven't had that sort of indoctrination that maybe their parents' generation have had against the architecture of this era. And it's always that sense that one tends to vehemently dislike the architecture of the preceding generation, but quite like the one before. For example, pre-war modernists hated Victorian architecture, didn't understand it at all, but quite like Georgian. The architects of the post-war era were quite interested in Victorian architecture, oddly. So there's this sort of natural cycle is going on. And then there's also the sense that this is brutalism's revival is inextricably linked to sort of online cultures as well. And the way that one constructs this sort of online persona or identity through the things that we're seen to be sharing or liking. And by aligning oneself with brutalism, which is still, widely hated and hated more widely than it's liked, there's the sense of aligning to its otherness. It photographs extremely well, you know, as you can see in the book in black and white, you know, these are sumptuous images. You can use it to sort of fashion this online identity for yourself. And that's, you know, vaguely political, I suppose, and it's sort of posing an alternative to the status quo. But then there's also been a lot of interest from people from a very left-wing position who, you know, look at the current situation that we face with the housing now, particularly the housing crisis, and, you know, looking to the past for a moment where the state in particular intervened very strongly and saw a housing problem, and both parties devoted huge amount of time, resources to alleviating that problem by building buildings now which are now reviled. I mean, I think it's very important to point out that the record for social housing was actually achieved by a Tory government. And, you know, during the 1950s, it really became a case of one-upmanship between Tories and Labour about who could build the most social housing units per year. And in some ways, the subsequent problems to do with quality were a result of those aspirations to build as much as possible.
Owen Hopkins there, speaking to this show's producer, Henry Reeves Sheridan. Hopkins' latest book, Lost Futures, The Disappearing Architecture of Postwar Britain, is a rather fetching number that's available now and published by the Royal Academy of Arts. Museum gift shops vary dramatically in form and quality. While the worst cheapen the artefacts on display by stamping their likeness on postcards or cheap tat, the best can provide a tasteful souvenir or gift that embodies the institution's values. London's Victoria and Albert Museum had a shop as early as the 1860s, and earlier this month, its latest space was unveiled. The brief befitting of the world's largest museum of decorative arts and design was to create a shop space to help promote the creative and manufacturing processes. The two main partners on the project were Friend and Company Architects and Millimeter Design. To find out more, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco paid a visit. He began by speaking to Adrian Friend, principal of Friend and Company Architects.
Adrian, first of all, congratulations for this beautiful new redesign of the shop. And let's start with almost like the entrance of the shop, the place where we're sitting now. It's a fantastic bench, which they didn't have it before. Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, the bench is one of the five different materials that we use in the shop, being made of cork, and it's been crafted and designed as a way of extending the sense of making and the processes of making within the shop, which is what we were really keen to use.
I believe this is the first kind of architecture intervention in the museum in about 11 years. That's quite astonishing. What were the main changes, would you say, that this new shop has compared to the old one?
The new shop is just more connected with the collections, more connected with the museum. It's just able to display and show so much more merchandising. I mean, there's so much more in the shop because we've done something quite clever. We've done away with the runway that was in the middle, and we've reintroduced new spaces. We've actually reintroduced two new pavilions into the shop, which gives more space and gives more displayable space as well.
Describe the pavilions for us. There's one, I believe, is the one with the jewelry in it, right?
We have two pavilions. One is the jewellery pavilion and the other one is what we call the pocket workshop. And they were sort of part of the narrative of making and craftsmanship that we wanted to bring into the design of the shop. But also we wanted to give the shop the opportunity to show some of the fantastic pieces that they commission and also to act as a kind of demonstrator space so that designers who make products that they sell in the shop can actually show how the products are made. So it's a lot about process and about revealing the processes of making behind the merchandise that they sell in the shop.
Let's talk a little bit about the lighting, which is also very important, I believe, in a shop, because it looks very kind of more open. Can you describe it? I think you can describe better than me.
The lighting we've just taken to another level. Firstly, we've created more height within the shop. So by removing parts of the ceiling that was here before, we found some additional space that we could display within the shop. And we realized because we had a much higher space, we needed more light. And so we've created this effect at high level called high-level lanterns. And essentially, they illuminate the space above the shop. And they also allow moving image to be shown on the lanterns. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that the lighting is specifically designed to make and display the product that's on the shelves and the merchandise that's on the shelves and just elevate that to another level. And I think from our side, it comes more from exhibition design and our interest in exhibition design and the way you think very carefully about lighting and the way you think very carefully about the atmosphere and the atmosphere within the shop.
What was your relationship with the V&A retail team, you know, when you're making the shop? Did they give you, like, freedom to do whatever you want? Or was there any consideration that you had to give, you know, because of the history of the museum or the way they sell their merchandising?
Yeah. I mean, the brief was amazing. It was a very, very in-depth brief, retail brief. which asked for very specific requirements that we had to meet. So they wanted more display space, they wanted better lighting, blah, blah, blah. But also the fantastic thing about working for the V&A and building a project within the V&A is that there's this history behind the museum, and they wanted to connect more with the museum, and they wanted to connect more with the history of the first shop. And the V&A arguably had a shop back in 1863 selling catalogues, and also used to sell slides of the collection, so visitors to the collection and the museum could go and commission a photograph of a particular piece and take it home with them. And they got that from the first museum shop. So the shop always was much more connected to the collection. And I think one of the nice things about working with the V&A is they said, well, look, can you go and do some research on the first shop, which we did, and see how that can inform the design. And then the other fantastic thing about the working for the V&A is that they really push you to make it more V&A. And that was always a challenge.
While at the shop, I also spoke with the head of retail for the Victoria and Albert Museum. Sarah Sevier tells me the best sellers of the shop.
It's a wide range, but on the whole, we sell scarves so well. And so we can sell scarves that are printed, we can sell one-off technical detail pieces of textile. We tell a story. Every time somebody buys a piece of textile that they want to wear, we are telling them either where the origins of it from the collection, or the detail and the understanding of who made it and why they made it and where they made it. Scarves generally are a great seller for us. And the other area is jewellery. We sell a lot of jewellery. We're not about fine jewellery, but any costume jewellery. And again, we're showcasing different makers and different materials, and it's very important for us to keep that refreshed regularly. But you know what? The best selling item is a ceramic button. And we sell thousands of them every year, and we have been selling them for probably about 7 or 8 years. And it's £3. Each one is handmade in a pottery in the countryside. And I understand that the lady who made them, when we first went to her, she had to buy another kiln. She had to take on more staff. She was literally working in her garden. And now they are so important for us that we have lots of different patterns, lots of different styles, and we've made them into little brooches, into earrings, but it all started with the ceramic button.
Sarah Savier, the head of retail for the Victoria and Albert Museum, and before that, Adrian Friend, principal of Friend and Company Architects, both speaking to Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and this show's bright-eyed, bushy-tailed producer, Henry Reese Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to bother Henry about them at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the self-same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. And please do feel free to leave us a review on the latter. It really helps people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fenner. Until next time, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.